Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, Rory Sutherland here. Sales and marketing teams, listen up. Have you got your tickets for the ALF Awards? On the 1st of May, ALF Insight will be celebrating the best sales and marketing teams in the media industry. Don't miss this hotly anticipated event and the opportunity to knit with all your clients, peers, and key industry leaders. So check out the shortlist and secure your seat by going to www.alfawards.com. That's www.alfawards.com. Hello and welcome to On Brand with Alf and me, Rory Sutherland. Each month I'll be talking to household names as well as challenger brands about success, challenges and future opportunities in the advertising, marketing and media industries. And today I'm joined by Christian Thrane, Managing Director of Marketing at EE&BT's Consumer Division. In 2023, EE became the flagship consumer brand for BT, which created the impetus for it to go on a journey with the aim of redefining itself to consumers. It's focusing on four key areas: home, game, work and learn. EE is developing a range of compelling products and services available to everyone, regardless of network, and designed to improve everyday life. EE is now one of the UK's largest subscription businesses, serving 25 million customers, backed by the UK's fastest mobile network and offering superfast connections. And at the end of last year, EE launched its new brand identity, ending 10 years of advertising featuring Kevin Bacon. Well, Christian, welcome to the podcast. Now, obviously, I don't normally introduce people where they actually have effectively two brands under their aegis. And so there is, obviously, just to be clear to everybody, BT bought EE in, I think it was 2016, is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct, Roy.
And effectively, therefore, it's actually, it was a merger of the two organizations. And going forward, overwhelmingly, though perhaps not in B2B, overwhelmingly the consumer-facing brand will become the EE brand. If you have a BT broadband router, over time, when you perhaps recontract, you'll end up with an EE contract. And if you replace your router, it will say EE on it. Why did you take the decision to lead with the EE brand, given, I suppose, that it's more recent than the BT brand, it's newer? What was the decision that the greater part of the equity lay in EE rather than BT?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a big question in many ways, isn't it? And it sort of takes us back to looking at the industry, looking at the role we want to play in the market to our customers, and it goes all the way back to sort of how can we become successful for the next 10 years and the future, not just for the next 2-3 years. We want to play a bigger role. We want to be more relevant to our customers. We want our customers to reappraise what we stand for and in many ways deliver a better joined up experience across the devices you have, the services you have, the networks you have, both in and outside your home. So we were faced with a discussion about which brand would then be the right one. And when you look at the BT brand and the EE brand, they're both very strong in their own rights, right? But EE is a more modern, more youthful brand. It's a brand that stands for more innovation and sort of travels better into other areas where BT is a strong brand, more reliable, secure. But we decided that EE would be the right brand for us to go with.
So I can say it is probably a little bit more modern as a brand. It also has the mobile heritage, which is kind of a funkier area. In other words, there's more innovation, there's a greater volume of transaction now. And indeed, you have a whole bunch of people, including my children's generation, who don't have a landline at all. And so, you know, any kind of residual kind of loyalty for BT as the provider of landline phones is pretty kind of hypothetical for that generation. And I suppose, of course, you've got a network of shops, which is kind of pretty useful for, in a sense, both the mobile business and the broadband business. But you actually started, if I'm right, at IBM. You're an IBMer in Denmark to begin with. Mm-hmm. So it'd be interesting to hear about your previous roles. And I understand you actually ended up at EE effectively post-merger. So you've never actually worked for a standalone EE or a standalone BT. Is that right?
That is correct. I have not been. I joined in 2020, 6 weeks into the first lockdown. So that was in itself a quite interesting journey. But I, as you're right, Rory, I started out. I'm Danish, and I started out with IBM in Denmark. And I did most of my projects in telecoms and in the intersection between strategy and technology. Coincidentally, my first project was a mobile content portal strategy and implementation for Orange World. So it becomes full circle in a way to come back here.
That was when you were working at IBM, was it?
This was at IBM, yeah. In very early days. This was pre-3G, pre-iPhone, pre-smartphone. So in many ways, we can come back to that when we talk about the industry, but it sort of speaks volume about sort of the type of role this industry has tried to take and when it's the right time and do you get behind it and do you do enough?
I mean, one thing I'm going to say is, I think it's fair to say over the last 5 years, I don't know whether this is a coincidence or whether it's a product of your joining. One thing I've noticed, this is slightly anecdotal. Generally, people don't get wildly excited about a mobile network or a broadband provider to the extent of kind of enthusiastically praising it, particularly when it's large. They might do that with a niche provider, but generally they don't. However, one thing I have noticed is that basically the volume of complaints about BT, and indeed my own experience of the customer service, shows a fairly remarkable improvement just in customer experience across the business. Now, you probably have metrics. It's a long time since I worked on BT. Mm. You probably have metrics to prove exactly that. But one of the things I have noticed is that someone made a decision, maybe you, to invest seriously in customer experience and customer service, in particular, you know, service on the telephone, for example, and that seems to have markedly improved to a point where you're no longer the whipping boy for everybody with a complaint or a gripe. Mm. And by the way, I'd also add that the reliability of the two networks is extraordinary in a way. I don't think this gets nearly enough credit in the marketplace, because generally we talk about things when they go wrong, or we talk about things that are amazing. We don't talk about things that are just reliable. Now, during the whole period of lockdown over 2 years, in which I was basically living on Zoom, I think in that 2 years, I had something like 7 minutes of wonky broadband. I mean, it might have happened at 3 o'clock in the morning, but I was asleep. But during my working day, I think in 2 years, I had 7 minutes of wonkiness, which is an extraordinary level of network reliability. And I don't think you get the credit, actually, for the quality of UK broadband, which, if we leave aside the odd, you know, rural not spot, is actually pretty good. I'd also say, I can say this now because we no longer work with Vodafone, I've got an EE phone and a Vodafone phone, and the 5G coverage on EE is markedly better. And so was there a conscious and deliberate effort in customer service and retention?
There definitely was. I can't take credit for all that. A lot of that work started before, as you said, BT acquired EE in 2016. Brought the organization together in one consumer division in 2018 under Margalera's leadership. I joined in 2020. When we brought the organizations together with one product team, one propositions team, one brand and marketing team, one base management team, mm-hmm. to sort of lead the direction forward, this journey has started. It has been surely a tremendous journey where we have improved our customer net promoter score for both BT and EE noticeably. We have brought down the number of complaints, as you say, from for BT worst in class to now best in class for both BT and EE. So I'm happy that you noticed, and I'm happy that.
I don't think improvements like this get noticed fast enough. And as a consequence, by the way, I think nearly all service organizations overinvest in acquisition relative to retention, simply because acquisition data reveals itself very quickly. You know, there's very fast feedback, and it's very easy to calculate an ROI, whereas retention data is slow. And so the common pattern I notice, I mean, you can actually see this on something like the BA website. If you're going there to buy a ticket, it's fantastic. If you're going there to check in, it's clear that nobody's actually invested in the sort of functional technology for the last sort of 7 years. And this kind of annoying disparity between companies which present a wonderful face to the prospect, but a terrible face to the customer. And I think the reason I'm mentioning this is because it doesn't get talked. It's not a news story, is it? People are not whinging about BT. It's not, you know, you're never going to put that in the front page of the Telegraph, as it were. But actually, it's something I've noticed myself, that it's no longer a kind of whipping boy for every journalist who wants to have a gripe. And someone told me as well, this may be true, maybe anecdotal, that part of what you did in the customer service thing is you made a really conscious effort to minimize repeat calls. So in other words, when someone calls with a problem, you solve the problem on that call rather than requiring kind of repeat interventions. And so that strikes me as a really, really intelligent move, because the thing that drives someone crazy isn't one crap event. We'll all forgive a business one crap event, but three crap experiences in a row, that's a completely different thing. And what you seem to have done is really eliminated that problem where you'd end up playing telephone tag, or, you know, someone would promise to ring you back and then they never did, or they never turn up to install your broadband when they promised. Those kind of what you might call recurring problems. So there seems to be a really conscious effort to get rid of those. And I, the reason I'm very keen to talk about this is because I don't think investment in these areas, first of all, is harder to justify. And when it succeeds, it probably doesn't get the plaudits it deserves. So, I mean, it sounds weird to, you know, praising, you know, large multinational organizations always sounds a bit weird, but I think it's important that we do that, actually, because there is this fundamental and recurring problem where, people are effectively providing a wonderful kind of, you know, front end to organizations, and then. And I think it damages the whole service economy, by the way, because it undermines trust. People go, well, I'd love to sign up for that subscription, but I know it'll be impossible to cancel it, so I won't. You know, that's the kind of thing which I think is becoming problematic. And so I think you're an outlier there, and you've gone against the trend, for which massive congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm very happy that you noticed that. And it also comes back to the way we have approached this whole rebranding of EE. For us, it was always more than a change of brand identity.
Yes.
It was always about building a genuine transformation and the role we want to play as a brand going forward. And we talked about building a new brand, a brand that could play a bigger and more relevant role to our customers. And we know that, and I'm sure you know better than most, Rory, that building a brand is much more than just what you say. It's about what you do. It's about creating an emotional connection with your customers.
Absolutely right.
Where no decision is 100% rational. There's always a pull. There's always a pull to one brand over the other, and even if you don't think about it, right? And that brand experience is what you do, is what you say. It's accumulated experiences over time. It's what customers say about your brand, and it sort of stresses the importance of your own channels and your product experience, and that's why for us we talked about building a new brand and used it as an opportunity to turn everything on its head and try to do better. This is a big place, and a lot of legacy systems and networks are not perfect, and in that it does require a tenacious approach to just keep improving, and we are by no stretch of the imagination perfect.
So I'm intrigued by this question of home, game, work, learn. Now, is that, in a sense, is it a customer segmentation? Is it I suppose in one sense those are the four core functions Certainly for people who treat their internet access or their for people who treat their connectivity as more than just a commodity. And there'll always be people who effectively just commoditize the whole thing and just want a cheap, you know, tolerable connection. But for people who actually care, who actually, you know, effectively are buying on quality rather than price, those probably are the four key areas. Do you treat it as a customer segmentation, or do you just treat it as a thematic kind of question? How does it inform your communications?
Yeah, so it's not a customer segmentation. We talk about them as customer needs or need states that, that customers have, and we have when we approach this whole rebranding of EE, we talked about becoming audience led. We talked about audiences. So we know audiences can have different needs. You can you could work from home, you can game, and you have kids who learn, and so they're not in any way segmentation. They're not mutually exclusive, but you have different needs at different points in time. And we found that when we talk about audiences, busy families with kids, you see when we launched our broadband, we used bedtime as an example. That chaotic time at 7 p.m. where kids don't want to go to bed because they're on their devices. Okay. Right. And we talked about how you can pause your Wi-Fi on your kids' devices, and instead of just using speed and a picture of a broadband hub, right? We talked about something that resonated with an audience and also broadly with other audiences. You don't have to be a busy family with young children. You can have had that before, you can be a grandparent, or you can have friends who have that, right? So you resonate and you see that, and that helps create an emotional connect. And we can see the response to that ad and to our ads in general are very, very strong, and because they talk to insights that are deeper, and that's what we found. That when we talk about audiences and begin to bring them to life like that, then we see that we get to deeper insights that resonate more with people, and therefore bring the brand to life in a different way.
So was it a difficult decision to drop Kevin Bacon? After all, it was a pretty good investment of 10 years, and it was in the EE brand, which was continuing. Was that a decision taken to reflect the merger and a new direction going forward? Was it a difficult decision?
It was surely one of the most frequently asked questions in the process. And if you think about Kevin Bacon, the role he has had for the EE brand, it's been phenomenal. He's been with us for more than a decade and has been synonymous with the EE brand. You see his face, you hear his voice, and you instantly know that it's EE talking to you. So we did approach that with a lot of focus, care, and thought. But at the same time, when you want to reinvent the brand, when you want customers to reappraise what EE is, not just the best mobile network in the country, but a brand that brings mobile, broadband, TV, and a whole set of new services in gaming and consumer electronics and other areas. We wanted customers to reappraise what we're all about. And when you do that, we felt that we need to show up differently. You can't say we're all different, but we show up the same, right? So there was an element of taking a brand. We always talked about we're 100% EE, but not as you know it. You'll recognize the colors, you'll recognize a lot of the things, but we have a slightly different tone of voice, we have different photography style, we have different, we've used our symbol in a different way, and created a modern platform where the people in our ads are not real actors, they are genuine people from across the UK, all walks of life. Gives us an opportunity to bring the role the brand wants to play to life in families across the country and show that. And then we still use Kevin. He's still with us, right? He is our voiceover, and that's a very strong asset, right? You hear his voice, and again, you hear it's EE, but we're different. But we spend quite a lot of time talking about how do we create a formula? How do we create a structure which is strong enough? And you bring it up now when we sit here 5 months later, and we almost forget that what a big leap it was, because we can see now from the very first ads, the ad recall, the salience, the brand appeal from the ads are up there with the best Kevin Bacon ads, and that's just changing overnight. And we did that by creating a very strong from a TV, I mean, we did much more than TV ads with the audience-led approach. But if you look at the TV ads, they all start with a with a point in time, something that people can resonate with, an iconic British song, music, and then the whole way of photography style and sort of brings it to life, and people instantly see that now it's EE talking. You don't see that with one ad. You see that when you see a couple of ads and you bring it to life. That's why we wanted to have a couple of ads from the beginning.
And you do have an interesting creative opportunity in being a large advertiser with an exclusively British audience. And, you know, one of the things I think we are slightly starved of in an age of kind of global advertising is seeing ourselves as Brits reflected in advertising. Because, you know, more and more of the large budget advertisers, the exception would be obviously their insurance comparison websites. There are categories which are still kind of national champions, but there are far fewer kind of national advertisements than there used to be. And I think, you know, advertising has lost a little bit of its meaning, and you are actually helping to bring that back, I think.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I think it was an important change for us to also move away from talking about BT or EE and our products and talk more about the audiences and how they use our products. That was a big shift as well in how we've approached it. Again, not talking about we will also talk about speed and these things that are important to the category, but we have turned the dial quite a lot in focusing more on how the customers, how the audiences use it, and we took this audience first approach very much in the sense that we talk about who are we talking to, what is relevant to them, where do we meet them, and I think one of my favorite examples is the approach we did to gaming, where we both show up on TV, where we talk about Sunday Fun Day and how you can use gaming to bring the family together, but we also know that even in gaming you have different audiences. You have social gamers, you have all-in gamers, you have parents who care about their kids gaming too much.
Too much, of course. Yes.
The different audiences. So we took an example where we built an EE game shop inside Fortnite and worked with a number of pro gamers to defend that shop. And so if you could go and win over these pro gamers, you could then get access to our store and get access to real hardware, right? And we streamed that on Twitch, and we saw an amazing engagement from our customers with that type of engagement.
That by the way, is an extraordinarily neglected audience in terms of both the value of the games industry, but also in terms of time spent. And I always think it's been hugely overlooked, largely because the people who work in marketing don't have time to be gamers. you know, to an extent. In other words, it's one of those things which is, it's rather like, you know, the popularity of things like American football in the UK, where the media industry catches on to the popularity 10 years later than the public. It's because, you know, there are lots of people in marketing who are really keen on rugby and soccer, and there just aren't that many, you know, from that era who are kind of that into American football. And so, and the same thing happened with computer gaming. Most of the people at the decision-making level, they probably have children who are gamers, but they aren't gamers themselves. And it's been completely overlooked as an advertising medium, I think. It's particularly given the sort of number of, you know, in terms of eyeballs, in both the number of eyeballs and the time those eyeballs spend fixated with games. It's been something where I think, you know, we have to say, you know, the advertising industry has been slightly remiss.
Yeah, and it's the revenue in gaming in its own right is bigger than TV and music combined. So it's a massive area. We there are different stats here, but we think roughly 40 million people in the UK game in one shape or form,
yeah.
All in game or social game or casual gamers. You have 14 million people watching.
That is an extraordinary phenomenon. Yeah, I mean, gaming is a spectator sport. It's also not male. As it once was, it's not nerdy as it once was, it's completely mainstream. But in some ways, I suppose the stereotyping of the early adopter target audience kind of coloured perceptions of the actual nature of that audience for about a decade and a half. And you're absolutely, and this is fascinating. I mean, the business of going on Twitch and watching gaming, which I must admit I can't fully get my head around. It's rather like I can't get my head around my children buying vinyl records. Why? we spent the first 20 years of our life trying to avoid this. I mean, there must be, you mentioned, of course, that one of the big applications alongside gaming is work. And I suppose the pandemic was in some ways a little bit of a gift to BT in terms of promoting flexible work.
Yeah, I know, but if you think about the timing of the pandemic, I mean, we can all be happy that that Zoom and Teams and all these things were so developed and were actually part of the way many companies had started to work, right? But it brought a focus.
I think it would have taken 10 years longer to get to, I mean, to be honest, there was a lot of it, which was effectively don't ask, don't tell. An awful lot of senior people I know used to work from home on a Friday routinely, but they never actually came clean about it. They just did it furtively. And what the pandemic did was accelerate the normalization of the behavior. You know, I think the desire for the adoption was already there. It just destigmatized it to a great extent because people, I mean, in a way, I always joke about this, but there are two reasons why people work from home. One is that they're lazy, and the other one is that they're busy. And actually, it can be both, of course. They're not mutually exclusive. But, you know, people who are very busy pretty rapidly spotted that it gave you an extra 2 hours in your day to get your productive work done. And that, you know, there were cost savings, quality of life improvements, everything else. And I mean, that's interesting. I find it interesting, by the way. I've always wondered whether BT should campaign for this. I think your employer should actually pay for your home broadband. And yet I haven't come across a single person, given that it is pretty much an essential requirement of, you know, performing after hours work and indeed flexible work. It seems to me weird. It would be obviously tax efficient for that to happen. But I've never known that happen, which seems strange to me.
I mean, you're right.
And mobile phones are quite commonly given to staff, you know. Broadband, almost never, as far as I can remember.
I mean, it's become a necessity for everyone, right? We all need to have that broadband connection, and the focus on the quality through the home is so important. There's so much development going on in that space that it's. I think you'll see a faster change of equipment in the home as well, with sort of Wi-Fi 7 coming in soon, and how that will improve the connectivity through.
So Wi-Fi 7 is what the next generation, the next iteration of home Wi-Fi. Tell me what sort of benefits is that a question of range, speed? What are the benefits?
Yeah, so with Wi-Fi 7, you'll be able to transport the speech through the home much, much better than what we have been able to before. You don't lose as much between the hub and the extenders. So that ability to deliver through gigabit speeds through the home will be much better than what we've seen before. So we're really looking forward to being able to bring that out to customers. So you will see a real difference.
Do you need newly compatible devices?
It will improve the experience also on devices that are not Wi-Fi 7 fully compatible, but you don't get the optimal speed. Say you are an all-in gamer, you may want to at some point change to Wi-Fi 7 enabled devices.
Quite a lot of them actually plug in, don't they? Because they're absolutely obsessed with ping speed. That's one of the any kind of lag is a disaster for the gamer.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting case with different technological priorities for different people.
It is, and it's also why it's also one of the reasons the gaming was sort of an optimal area for us to go into, because there's so much new services, subscriptions, hardware, accessories. But at the same time, it also is important for the network, right? So it's one of the most key use cases for both the mobile and the broadband network. So that was a key area for us to get into.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Top Two Challenges, brought to you by ALF Insight.
ALF Insight helps media owners, agencies, and marketing service providers improve their new business pipelines by equipping them with in-depth insights, accurate information, and daily news updates on the leading and challenger brands in the UK. ALF now also helps sports clubs, venues, and charities win new partnership deals. ALF Insight identifies the brands to target at the right time, providing everything you need to tailor the perfect pitch. Visit ALF Insight, that's ALFinsight.com, or click the link in the episode description to find out more. What's the biggest challenge for EE in maintaining pole position? And what would you say, that's the brand-specific question, and what would you say is the biggest challenge for the telecoms industry as a whole?
Yeah, but first, I mean, starting with the first one, I mean, I think it's important to say that the industry is moving at an incredible pace. Technology in the world in general, AI and all these things, right? So our strategy for EE was always about recognizing that we have to adapt. We have to embrace it and we have to build capabilities for the future to stay relevant. It was always about building a business, not just to survive, but to thrive and be part of shaping it, building a platform business that allow us to leverage the assets we have, all the assets across stores, retail, digital, the data we have access to, and turn that into relevant recommendations and better experiences for the customers and help them get more out of technology, whether it's hardware, subscriptions, or the connectivity, leveraging the fact that if you think about it in many ways, so many businesses, so many industries are trying to become subscription businesses. Whether you are a car company trying to sell your cars on, on a subscription, or you are a dog food company trying to become a subscription business, running a recurring revenue. We always have been, right? But we might have forgotten some of the elements to use it to the max. We're very good at driving down cost per acquisition and acquiring customers. We're pretty good at retaining customers as well. But leveraging that capability, all those assets to create a stronger relationship with customers and do more for them was always a core part of it. And I look at this as a way to, so if you look at what is our biggest challenge, I think it is making sure that we follow through, that we get behind this enough and that we build the capabilities fast enough for us to be relevant for customers. In a company like ours, there's so many legacy systems and old technology that we also need to work on top of, right? So it's simplifying the business, moving fast enough and getting behind it in a way that we can actually play the role we aspire to play for our customers. Because if we do that, I'm confident that we can thrive in the future as well. We have a unique platform, unique assets, unique partnerships.
You do. And actually, what's quite interesting about it is you've actually achieved, in a sense, not quad play, but tri play. I suppose you, I mean, EE and BT are presumably, they're slightly backing out of the TV and space. Is that fair?
Well, we're not backing out of the TV space. We have created a joint venture for sport, which is separate, right? We still have our EE TV. You'll see us come to life with sort of above the line advertising for our EE TV platform relatively soon, with an opportunity for EE to show up as a modern new provider of TV in the UK. So we're not backing out of TV in any way. So that triple play, but as you say, we want to be more than a triple play provider. We want to be able to sell. We don't want. If you think about it, historically, you've had to have a SIM card with us or a broadband connection to be a customer. Now, we have built not just a new brand, but an entirely new stack that allows us to create a customer ID which sit above the stack. The way you think about an Amazon Prime account or Google account, an Apple ID, sits above the stack so that you're able to buy a gaming console with us on a 48 months installment with a subscription, insured, secured from us, whether you are a Vodafone or a Virgin customer. Obviously, you get a better experience when you connect it to our network and we're able to follow through and integrate with partners and create a better experience, but you can. And we don't want to hold ourselves back. We create a platform that's open to anyone across the UK.
And I suppose triple play, it was always amused me because the great promise was quad play or triple play. And it was a great promise to the investor community that people would immediately put all their eggs in one basket. And they would have, and what seemed to happen was people, particularly in the UK, actually were really resistant to this. They'd have BT broadband, they'd have a Vodafone phone. In other words, they'd have they generally have their landline from the same person who provided their broadband, but that was about as far as it went. And actually, there were huge efforts made from Vodafone trying to get into the broadband space. Obviously, Sky trying to get into the mobile space. And it was rather like the energy companies where everybody was effectively trying to sell you everything. And it didn't really work. But you've actually brought the two together, probably two at the right time, because the divide between, if you like, your mobile network and your Wi-Fi network at home is now blurrier, isn't it, really? With Wi-Fi calling, for example, it's become much, much blurrier than it was. Whereas before, we did see those things as absolutely separate compartments, and maybe we just had a kind of jack of all trades assumption that we'd choose best in class from three different providers. Say you'd have Sky Television, you might have EE Mobile, you might have BT broadband connection. You seem to have actually, first of all, brought these two things together in a sense by merging two companies rather than by everybody trying to sell everybody everything. And now probably is the moment where that promise can really be fulfilled, isn't it? Because they were kind of, my mobile phone network and my home broadband, I did think of conceptually as two entirely separate things, 5-6 years ago. Now I'm not sure I do. I'm starting to see connectivity as just an overall good, and I'm more and more neutral as to, which particular part of the bandwidth spectrum it comes through.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, if you think about a lot of the things we do, you do both in and out of the home. You talked about the importance of working from home before. Now, as you can get outside, you're no longer in a lockdown situation. You want to work well from anywhere, right? So it has become different in that sense. A lot of the services, a TV service, you also watch anywhere. It's no longer confined to a box in your living room.
No.
If you think about gaming as well, most of your services, security, I think, will be increasingly important as well. Network security, and how you think about that across mobile and broadband, you'll see service-aware networks that will optimize the experience depending on the type of service you use, right? And you can imagine that we would create subscriptions that would be optimized for a different service for a certain service that would then optimize whether you're in your home and outside your home as well. So those are the types of things that will bring it together.
So in terms of the general category, I mean, do you see an ultimate threat from, say, Starlink, from Elon Musk? In some ways, it slightly reduces your obligation to install high-speed fiber to every single rural location. So I guess there's a slight benefit to Starlink in some respects. But do you see longer-term threats from other technologies which effectively go over the top, or are you less concerned about that?
Well, so I think there'll be a combination of network access forms that we can bring to our customers and deliver value on. I don't like the notion. Some people talk about network becoming a utility. I don't like that notion. I think delivering networks and quality over time is complex.
Yes.
And delivering that with quality is important. And I think the good thing about being in our business is that demand for network is certainly not going down. It's not going anywhere, right? No. That's going up. And the demand for quality is only going up as well, for higher quality content, gaming, augmented reality, virtual reality, autonomous vehicles, remote access to doctors, operations. I mean, AI processing power in the cloud or in our edge network or on the device, our ability to integrate with partners all the way into their servers to create a better experience. I mean, there's so much in delivering a great network experience that will stay and it will only go up. I think when you look at the industry and some of the challenges, then I think it is our challenge to make sure that we are able to effectively tell the difference between different network experiences and charge properly for it. And I think without this becoming a regulatory sort of exercise, we can do that some other time, then I think the UK is very focused on cost, and the cost in the UK for these services are not very high, and
no.
It's more focused on the cost than providing the conditions that make operators invest in a way that would deliver the best networks across the UK. we have the best network, but it's still, if you compare us internationally,
I mean it's anything but a utility. I mean, the extent to which utilities are regulated slightly disturbs me in a way, because you have Ofcom and Ofwat and all these people who are absolutely determined that no one makes a reasonable amount of money supplying people with things which are essential. Now, the same people who will save 50p a month on their broadband will go and buy a pair of sunglasses for 90 quid. There is something which always bothers me, which is in some ways there's a kind of conversation which treats water, electricity, which are of strategic importance, and of course broadband connectivity and mobile connectivity, as though they are utilities. In other words, something you buy grudgingly for as low a price as you can possibly pay. I think that's also slightly probably exacerbated by in the companies that provide those businesses, the kind of mentality of economics is very strong, and the mentality of kind of cost reduction and efficiency gains rather than what you might call value creation tends to be strong. You know, if you have a very strong engineering culture, if you have a very strong finance or economic culture, the marketer has a much more difficult job in fighting for value on rather than money off. And I think we have made that mistake, which is that, every year I have 15 or 20 occasions where, either mobile connectivity or broadband connectivity is something you'd literally pay £100 for. It's mission critical. And yet we're almost being encouraged by the media to buy these things as if, you know, it's a monstrous injustice that you have to pay for them at all. But if you do pay for them, you should obviously pay as little as possible. And yet at the same time, you have a luxury goods sector. You know, that kind of article will appear next to an advertisement for, you know, a tie that costs 50 quid or whatever. And this seems to me completely out of whack, the extent to which network goods, things that are actually essential to our survival and functioning, get bought much more grudgingly than things we don't need. And I find that a strange facet of the economy as a whole.
You know, I agree with that. And that is, I mean, now you talked about what is the challenge for EE and what's the challenge for the industry. I think that's a challenge for both EE and the industry to make sure. I mean, we provide the best mobile network. We've done so for more than a decade, as measured by RootMetrics. But we still need to be able to communicate more effectively the value of being on a better network and a more secure network and charge probably for that.
One strange mystery which you might be able to help me with is I've never understood. I worked with Vodafone for a time, and both I and the creative director were basically saying, why don't you tell people about Wi-Fi calling? Because about 50% of people have a phone that where Wi-Fi calling is perfectly possible, and yet it's switched off by default. And I can never understand why none of the mobile networks, because after all, the main cases now, apart from being in really remote countryside or the middle of the Gobi Desert or something, the main cases where you can't get adequate mobile connectivity are actually indoors, they're downstairs, they're in a basement bar, you know, a cottage where you've rented an Airbnb, where there's perfectly adequate Wi-Fi for you to connect your phone and make and receive phone calls and so on. And yet, I've never understood why nobody ran an ad campaign just telling people there's a simple thing you can do that's free that effectively improves your mobile coverage or reduces your mobile coverage problems by about 90%. And yet nobody made the effort to tell anybody about it. Do you have any idea? You came from Denmark, where I always imagine that everybody in Denmark knew about Wi-Fi calling and had turned it on day one. But that always struck me as a weird kind of dog that didn't bark in the night.
I'm afraid I can't tell you the whole. I mean, the full story about that is probably one of those things where it's a feature on the phone rather than our network. And I think we have absolutely been talking to our customers about it, but not in an ATL perspective. We have talked to customers more on a one-to-one and or one-to-many perspective in our base comms in our customer service. We definitely still do that. So we bring it to life like that, but it has not been a differentiating sort of above the line campaign.
No, it's funny that because for both of us, you see, we said, you know, we both learned about it. I learned about it from my kids and my colleague learned about it from his niece. And in both cases, we said it was the most transformative movement of a switch we'd made in 5 years. And yet nobody was talking about it. I mean, there are some strange aspects, aren't there, which is that what telecoms people think is important becomes quite heavily misaligned with what consumers actually care about. In other words, engineers will tend to optimize things that engineers massively care about. And actually, consumers actually have a pretty different set of priorities. And I think it's very easy for engineering-driven organizations, you see it with railways, to become very badly misaligned with the interests of everyday consumers.
Yeah, no, I think that's one of the things that we are trying to address with our more audience-led approach. I talked about the way we think about audiences, the minute you start talking about a busy household with kids who game, or a group of customers who were empty nesters, where their kids come back over the weekend or stay with them for a period of for some months because they don't have an apartment, or you realize that your needs change. Right? You bring to life that now all of a sudden you need high speed, or you need the right TV channel. So you sort of start seeing opportunities when we talk about audiences like that. We start talking about how you can swap your benefits, how you can boost your network, and how you can do things that are customer-led, customer insight-driven more than engineering-led. And I think that has been a big change to how we communicate and how we think. And then I think you are pointing to something that I think most advertising and marketing teams are a little bit guilty of. It is when you've said something once, you don't want to say it again, right? It's like there is this element, but it's still the most important thing for the customer. So keep saying it. And
yes, we get bored with our messages long before the consumer does. And as David Ogilvy always said, you're not advertising to a standing army, you're advertising to a moving parade.
Exactly.
You know, there are always people who are either entering the market for something, or they're newly in the market for something because their circumstances change. And you're absolutely right about that. People tend to do it. Oh, we've done that, so it never needs to be reset.
Which was one of the things that we wanted to bring to life with our customer needs, or what we call need states. That when you look at home, you think to take a point in time like home move. You're not moving home all the time, but when you are moving home, you need help. You need the broadband to work. You need help in a time of chaos, and you make a whole lot of purchase decisions at that point in time. So doubling down, helping out customers at that point in time, or we, as we talked about earlier, you talked about whether homework, game and learn, where it was segments, and they're not mutually exclusive. There's a point in time where it's important for you to work anywhere, or there's a point in time where entertainment is important, or gaming is important. There's a point in time where you care disproportionately about your children's education, just preschool, and setting up and making all the purchases. So that mindset of a need state and what customers are needing right there and then is important.
I've got an ironic assertion, which is it's actually time to bring back the phone box as a video conferencing booth. Because if you're on the move and you need to actually do a video call, it's an absolutely bizarre nightmare, because you generally what you have to do is find a very unpopular cafe and then order three gratuitous coffees. Yeah. But there are, you know, as I said, everything, it's a very, very fast moving sector where, you know, in some cases, you know, technologies we assume are redundant, maybe will come back into their own, who knows, you know. It's fascinating too, as I said, because of this very, very unjust thing, which is people find a day without broadband at home almost intolerable, you know. And yet their willingness to pay, and their willingness to pay for, or even, you know, appreciate improvements in quality, is surprisingly grudging. And that does strike me as one of the most peculiar facets of human psychology, that we're, you know, we're mean about things that are essential, and we're extraordinarily lavish about things we don't need. And, you know, there's a little bit of me which is actually happy to see energy prices go up, because I think energy is vitally important. If there is some surplus money for the energy sector to invest in redundancy and resilience and alternative forms of generation, well, that's all to the good. And yet we buy those things as if it's the most painful distress purchase you can imagine.
Yeah, but you're right. But that is one of our challenges, to make sure that we make customers aware. And I think that's one of the things that I sometimes when I talk to my team, we talk about how we historically in broadband delivered 100 megabit or 500 megabit to the wall. Now what we're doing is we're giving the broadband a front end on your phone. We're giving it a Wi-Fi control. So we're telling you how it works and where it doesn't work and how we're optimizing. You know what we?
So you're concretizing the whole thing. So you yeah.
We're making it visible yeah. to you. If you live in a big apartment block, your broadband might not be optimized because there's interference from your neighbors, right? So we might change the band. So you have a better experience. Or we could tell you that you have a device that's not set up right and it's taking up too much bandwidth. Or we can tell you that with the size of your home, you need another extender so that you get a proper experience.
I've got two of those. They're absolutely fantastic. I use them in the garden in the summer. Yep. So I can beam my broadband out to the garden and work in the garden, which is
but very few customers buy a speaker and put it at the ground floor, then go to second floor and expect to hear the same quality of music, right? You don't, right? And there is an element of education as well that you won't get the proper experience of connectivity throughout your home if you don't buy those extenders, depending on the size of your home, of course. But if you have two floors or if you have a number of bedrooms, then you will need one or two extenders to get that right experience you expect.
And you only have to ask. They sent me one. Actually, they sent me two for free, which I thought was I wasn't expecting that. So there we are. A little bit of a plug there, if you like. But I notice your job title, interestingly, is you're actually managing director of marketing for EE Consumer Division. Now that's not a job title I've come across before, but. Was it created specifically for the position? It seems interesting to me because it certainly suggests that you do have input further upstream, which often marketers don't. I mean, that's the other great problem is, I found one of the most peculiar things I found, for example, in the telecoms industry was pricing for 5G, where you'd invested billions in this technology, and yet you more or less gave 5G away at exactly the same kind of subscription price that people were paying for 4G. Now, to me, this was really, really odd. I don't know what drove that, because I would have thought at least there was going to be a four-year period of premiumization where you paid a few pounds extra to have either 5G access at all or elevated 5G access. And yet this decision seemed to be taken by a bunch of engineers who seemed to be blind to the possibilities to premiumize your mobile connectivity.
Yeah, no, I can tell you it's not taken by engineers. It's taken by the pricing teams. But it's back to whether other operators are doing it right. So there is an element of making sure that
it's
as an industry,
to the
exactly, yeah. right. And so you refer to my time. I mean, it's marketing in telecoms is typically a broad area. I'm responsible for all our products, our propositions and pricing, our partnerships, our base value and personalization teams, as well as the brand and Marcom. So it's a broad role in the sense with a responsibility for the revenue side of the P&L, if you like. And that's where marketing plays a much bigger role in driving the change of the direction of the company and the customer insights come in and play a bigger role in how we think and how we talk. And Mark Alero, my boss, is very actively involved in these conversations, has been throughout, a core architect for how we've been driving this direction, right? So it's a role where marketing, strategy, technology come together and talk about the role we want to play as a brand going forward. That whole discussion that I had about creating an EE ID and an EE account that sit above the core stack was a core part of how we think about
it. In other words, it transcends it transcends the whole question of which network you're using or for what.
Yes.
And you are an EE customer, even if you don't have EE at home, even if you don't have EE on your mobile, you still have a relationship.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. And actually, what you've done is, in a sense, you've managed to do triple play backwards, which is, you know, is really quite interesting.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, this industry has been on a journey, right, where BT sold off mobile years back, acquired back EE later. So I mean, it's an interesting industry in that sense. We're very clear that we believe solving problems through in and out of your home connectivity across your devices, services, subscription, and network experience, and connecting all the devices that can be connected, will be an important part of of how we can play a bigger role and how we can also be more robust against any new type of competitors that will come in. Connecting all your devices makes it very different, right? So that's the type of role we want to play.
This is absolutely fantastic. Well, I mean, first of all, as I said, congratulations, because as I said, I think it's fair to say I've noticed two things, both the quality of my own experience, but also the general quietening down of BT stroke E's whipping boy for, you know, whenever the media fancied a gripe. Also, by the way, I mean, your investment in customer service and customer experience is commendable, because it's harder to justify, isn't it? You invest in acquisition and there's an ROI case. It's very, very easy to build a business case. If you have an ROI obsessed business, which only allows you to do things which are absolutely quantifiable down to the penny, it's quite easy to invest in acquisition. Investing in customer service is obviously a fuzzier business, because yes, it pays off in the shape of retention and it pays off in the shape of brand reputation. But translating that to an actual figure is a much tougher exercise. So that investment is very, very hard nowadays to make the case for that in a kind of world obsessed with direct accountability. And so that investment's all the more commendable, because it must have required a hell of a lot of work and a hell of a lot of justification. So congratulations for that too.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. No, and we can see it, as I talked about. We can see it with higher net promoter score. We can see it with lower churn and now industry low complaints as well. So it definitely has paid off. So if you look at it like that and look at it as almost a case study over time, you can look at the benefits very clearly now in hindsight and see that it was worth it.
It was worth it. It just you've got to just think more than one quarter ahead to justify the case.
Yeah, and it never stops,
which
right?
Not everybody can
and
do.
It never stops. It never stops, right? I mean, networks are, and again, we are by no stretch of the imagination perfect, right? They, running a network is a continuous improvement exercise, and then leveraging that platform that we're building now to play a bigger role and make sure that customers notice when we improve the network and we talk to customers about how things get better. And how they can control things,
yes.
and make that come to life for customers is where we're at.
That is absolutely tremendous. Well, Christian, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. It's been a pleasure to chat to you. You've been listening to On Brand with Alf and Rory Sutherland. If you want to do business with EE or any other telecoms brand, contact the Alf Insight team on their website, which is www.alfinsight.com. That's alfinsight.com. You can also find the link in the episode description below. The series is produced and expertly edited, as ever, by Ultimate Content. And to make sure you receive the next episode, please do subscribe. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard, then tweak the algorithm by giving us a like or subscribing. And thank you for listening, and here's to next time.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.